The case that we'll hear argument on is United States v. Ferguson. This is 20-7045.
May it please the court, I'm Barbara Waltz, representing Randall Ferguson today.
Ms. Wilson, let me just ask you, for the purposes of our recording equipment, if you, it's certainly appreciated,
I actually meant to take it off, Judge. Thank you.
All right. Well, totally up to you.
I was just going to ask you to
talk a little louder, you know, so, okay.
Okay. Thank you. When Randy Ferguson stood accused of possession of child pornography, the United States Constitution afforded him certain rights, the same rights that anyone in our country is afforded when they are accused of a serious federal crime. Mr. Ferguson comes before this court today to ask for relief because the proceedings below violated his rights in three different ways. First, Mr. Ferguson was not competent and had actually been found to be not competent by the trial court, and it was a violation of due process for the trial court to reverse that decision and to force Mr. Ferguson to go to trial when he was not competent. Second, the trial court violated Mr. Ferguson's right to a fair trial by admitting 10 videos of child pornography and 15 still images of child pornography without doing the weighing that is required by Rule 403. Third, Mr. Ferguson's rights to a fair trial were also violated because the government and the government's lead witness, the lead FBI agent, changed their position regarding a key piece of evidence on which the defense relied, and they changed that position in the midst of trial. For all three of these reasons, we ask that you grant Mr. Ferguson relief. Going back to the competency issue, the facts were undisputed that Mr. Ferguson, when he was a young man, was in two serious motor vehicle accidents that left him with traumatic brain injuries. The Social Security Administration had found him to be completely disabled. So when he was charged with possession of child pornography, he met with his attorneys, and they were immediately alarmed that he was completely unable to assist them in any way with his defense. And they filed for competency. And I'm going to point out a few things that are important about this, but the first one is that they didn't file on that first prong of the competency statute. They agreed that he understood in general what the legal process was, what the criminal process was, what the consequences, the possible consequences were. That wasn't what they filed on. They filed on his inability to assist his counsel. And the trial court did grant that initial, you know, petition and sent Mr. Ferguson off to FMC Fort Worth to be evaluated. And the second thing that's important to note is that at that time, the objective testing, which the experts called the gold standard, which is this Ray test, R-E-Y, even when it was administered by the government doctor at FMC Fort Worth, showed no malingering on the part of Mr. Ferguson. Let me say that a little more clearly, no malingering. And that was all of the objective testing that was done at that time showed that. And then there was a hearing in 2018, and at the end of that hearing, Judge White found, by the preponderance of the evidence, that Mr. Ferguson was not competent because he could not assist his counsel in his defense. And then the federal statute requires a second evaluation, and the statutory language, the purpose of that second evaluation is to see if he can be restored to competency. The language says that to see if he can attain competency within a reasonable time. And so Mr. Ferguson then went to FMC Butner for that second evaluation. And that's where the government deviated and really violated the statute on competency because they didn't try to see if they could restore him to competency. They didn't take the standard approach, the lead witness on behalf of the government, who's Dr. Marquez, testified that she decided to take a non-standard approach.
What about Dr. Pinuto?
Excuse me?
What about Dr. Pinuto?
Yes, and she, I pointed out in our briefs a couple of places that she said she was not evaluating competency.
Well, but what she did evaluate, did she not, and testified that in about five different tests, including the Ray test that you mentioned just a moment ago, that he did exhibit substantial indicia of malingering, and that his ability to remember things was entirely inconsistent, according to Dr. Pinuto, between his recollection of evidence of information regarding the crime and everything else. And so she testified, did she not, in the second competency hearing for 2019, that he did exhibit substantial indicia of malingering.
I believe that was her testimony. Again, the test that she administered to Mr. Ferguson were not these gold standard tests. These were tests that they went and found other tests and to try to see if they could show signs of malingering. And these were not the gold standard tests.
I thought one of the tests was the very test that you relied on just a moment ago in the 2018 conference.
I heard what you said, Judge. I did not realize.
And I may be wrong about that.
Yes, and I'd have to go back and look. I did not think that she re-administered the Ray test the third time. That was my memory of the record, is that they decided not to re-administer those tests because they'd already been administered twice.
Okay.
And the ones that she went to get, our expert testified, were not suitable, were not the kinds of tests that you give to somebody who has brain damage. You give those to people who are maybe faking a delusion or something like that, but not to somebody who has brain damage. And so they went out and found evidence by using tests that did not apply to Mr. Ferguson. And so after the 2019 hearing, the entire ruling by Judge White was that he found Dr. Marquez more persuasive than the defense expert. And our position is, and I think the standard of review that is in our opening brief supports this, that was not evidence that leaves you convinced that was the correct, that finding by Judge White does not leave you convinced that the right decision was made because of Dr. Marquez's testimony that she was not taking the standard approach. And I also think that if you go back to her testimony, she held against Mr. Ferguson on the second prong that he was competent on the first prong. She found discrepancies where there weren't discrepancies. This is just the way his brain damage left him able to do some things and not able to do other things.
What about her testimony that she had specifically told the defendant that, look, I know you are claiming that you are actually innocent and that these are some techniques that you could utilize in order to help you be able to remember things. And he said, according to Dr. Marquez, no, I don't need that. That won't help. And so she was able to, she testified that was at least part of her rationale in opining that he really was malingering. He really didn't have the extent of memory loss that he purported to have. How can we say that was not at least contributing to substantial evidence to support Judge White's finding?
Judge, I think there's several places where Mr. Ferguson explains that when he looks at his old notes from a previous time, he can't remember what they had anything to do with. The exception was this calendar thing. Apparently he has trained himself with these things he can do with his brain injury and the things he can't do with his brain injury. He's trained himself to write things down in a calendar form where that does remind him of what meetings he needs to go to. But simply notes about his case, apparently that he explained that just was not the sort of thing that was helpful to him. If I could move on to the other two issues. The second issue is the one with the images, and I'd like to make my argument brief on that this point, but I'd like to ask this panel to apply the Peralt case, which was decided by another panel in April of this year, where they recognized this idea of the need for a trial court to make serial analyses as the evidence comes in. In this case, we had 25 separate items that the government wanted to put in. And so even if at the beginning of the 25, there was probative value that was not outweighed by the unfair prejudice, the probative value goes down as more and more of these images are shown to the jury. And the parole court recognized the Cunningham Third Circuit, I think it is, decision where they actually reversed based on the trial court putting in too many really graphic images of, you know, not just child pornography, but really horrible things. And they said that the trial court had not done the analysis, even if the first one was probative and there was not unfair prejudice to outweigh it, that he hadn't done that serial analysis of all of the things. And they actually reversed on that. And the Peralt case, was different. It was a Rule 414 case about how many 414 witnesses can testify in a child molestation case. It wasn't a child pornography case, but they still recognized that principle from Cunningham. And the government has asked this court to use what, I need to refer to this, but what one court called the mathematical test, that if there were a lot of images on the computer and only 25 of those were used, that's fine because that's a very small number. And that's actually what the district court said in his ruling on our post-trial.
There were 2,000 images and 50 videos, and I think they did 10 videos and 15 images they showed to the jury.
Right, and we cite to a case in
but
our...
But I think also the trial court made sure that they were very short clips with no sound. I mean, it wasn't just that it was a smaller number.
Well, I don't think the trial court did that. The government said, well, we'll play the first five in their entirety, and it depends on your definition of short. It was over 6 minutes for those five, those first five that were shown in their entirety. The record doesn't show how many seconds of that second five, the ones 6 through 10 were shown, but enough so that the government witness could say, yeah, I saw that one, it's child pornography. And then the 15 still images, Judge. So I understand your point, but the mathematical test, and we do have the case that's in there, and I apologize for not being able to recall its name, that rejected that test because that's not how Rule 403 works. It doesn't say, oh, well, if you've got 1,000 images out there, then you get to show a proportionate amount of those 1,000 images. It's this, what's the probative value versus the unfair prejudice? Right. And that's what
and
didn't happen
And you have to show
here.
Abuse of discretion. That's how do you show abuse of discretion, though,
in terms of what
the trial court admitted here?
How do I show?
Abuse of discretion.
Abuse of discretion is because,
standards.
Number one.
Because you admit it's relevant, and we've held these types of images are relevant and can be shown to the jury. Correct?
Yes.
So how do you show that the balancing that the judge did, recognizing that's not on the record necessarily, how do you show that that was an abuse of discretion?
Well, Judge, I think it's significant that it's not on the record. I think we have no reason to think that he did a balancing. And I hate saying that, but there's just nothing on the record that indicates that he weighed this at all. And then
there's no authority, though, that requires the judge to state that on the record, is there? I mean, I didn't come up with any.
Well, we would like for this to be the case where there's authority for that because we do cite to other circuits who have said, yeah, the court has to have looked at these things and he has to have made a finding on the record. And I would ask that you make this the case to do that.
Well, we've got cases where we've said that where the judge doesn't do that balancing on the record, just makes the decision essentially that we can infer or it's implicit from the record what essentially that balancing was. We've got those kind of cases.
Right. Again, here we
cited anybody cited them, but they're there.
Right. Here we don't really have an indication that Judge White had even looked at these images before trial. He never says that on the record anywhere. So we don't know that he had even in his head made a weighing decision. If I could very briefly on the third point, that's the one where the government and their witness changed his position on whether these other computers that were seized at the same time in 2014 had child pornography on them. that's an unfair trial when the government creates this idea that there was child pornography on these additional computers. No one forced Agent Rivers to come into that room where the defense attorneys were there and the government attorneys were there and to say, there is child pornography on those computers. He didn't say, there's some questionable images on those computers and we don't feel like we can give those to you. So he created that idea. The idea went all the way up until his redirect testimony at trial. And that's an unfair trial because it affected Mr. Ferguson's ability to put on a defense. We would ask that you grant Mr. Ferguson relief.
I have a question, but I'm going to give you a minute for rebuttal so you can keep the, Kevin, you can keep the time off. How does this interplay with your second argument? In other words, so if the government had not changed his position and Agent Rivers had not changed his position on laptop number two, the boy's computer, there would have been two images that depicted child pornography. The government introduced those, presented those, as I understand the record, at trial. And as Judge Moritz pointed out, you have acknowledged that the image, that at least to some extent, the images of child pornography in the one laptop that was accessible to the father, to Ferguson, was, you know, had images of child pornography. Now, the government's theory, I think, originally before the alleged change, was those images were nothing like the two images that were on the boy's laptop. And so to some extent, not only did this have the characteristic that's unusual, that the government had to present evidence of child pornography, but to some extent, to defeat your theory of a defense, they had to show that this child, it's child pornography is not child pornography. This child pornography that was on laptop one was qualitatively different, not only in number, but also in what it depicted, than the two child pornographic images on the boy's laptop.
Well, I can see your point, and if that had been the entire government opinion, it still would have been, to some extent, I think, a violation of Rule 16, because Agent Rivers was put on as an expert witness, and he is the one who said, this is child pornography, and didn't qualify that in any way. And if there was a change in that or a refining of that opinion, I think that should have been disclosed to the defense ahead of time. But it's still not the same thing as the very prejudicial thing that they did put on. And if I could make one more point about that, about harmless error on that point. If Agent Rivers hadn't said that in that room on that day, we have no idea what the defense would have presented at trial. They would have gotten those computers. They would have had the opportunity to investigate those computers. So we really can't replay. We can't go back in time and say, oh, well, this is harmless error because they got a chance to put on their defense. If he hadn't started this whole idea that there was child pornography on those computers, the defense may have gone in a completely different direction.
Well, the defense counsel knew. He watched those two videos. Is that really fair? The defense counsel had gone to the FBI site and had seen those two images.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
But that was right before trial, Judge, because right. The way the process worked, it had happened right before trial. So from the summer, okay. If they would have had those computers, who knows what direction the defense would have gone in, is my point. Okay. So we can't say this was harmless error.
Okay.
Thank you, Judge.
Did you?
That's all right. Yeah, okay. I think that answered the question. Okay. Thank you.
May it please the court, Michael Quinn for the United States. Despite his decades-old brain injury, Randy Ferguson was able to get married, raise children, drive a car, and exercise daily at the gym. Unfortunately, he was also able to use peer-to-peer software to search for and download a vast collection of child pornography onto his computer. His brain injuries did not prevent him from entering search terms such as Lolita and Daddy's Little Girl, and from storing a collection of over 1,900 images and over 50 videos of child pornography. The one thing he says he can't do because of his brain injuries is assisting his defense. The district court held a competency hearing at which Dr. Panuzzo and Dr. Marquez testified for the government that Mr. Ferguson was malingering and exaggerating or feigning his memory deficit symptoms. On the other hand, Dr. Hall testified for Mr. Ferguson that he was not competent to stand trial. The district court listened to all this testimony. Both experts explained their reasoning and faced cross-examination. And at the end of it, the district court found that Dr. Marquez is simply more persuasive. This court has said over and over again that a district court is entitled to credit the findings of one expert witness and to discount the contrary findings of another, and that no clear error exists in that circumstance. That's exactly what happened here, and for that reason, we ask the court to affirm the district court's decision on the competency issue.
Well, counsel, can I just ask you, your opposing counsel suggests that really the district court didn't have a decision because it adopted one expert's report, but that was not supported by proper testing. I mean, that just wasn't an option. As I understand, that's the argument.
So we disagree with that, Your Honor, and for a couple reasons. First, as a preliminary matter, the district court's analysis in the Makovich decision was just as brief as the district court's decision here. The Makovich district court also just said one expert is more persuasive than the other, and this court affirmed in that case. As far as the testing, Judge Bacharach, you were correct. The RAID 15 test was readministered again at Butner, and Mr. Ferguson scored quite poorly on that test, only 7 out of 15, which indicated likely feigning. The other objective tests that Dr. Panuzzo conducted included the California Verbal Learning 2 test. Mr. Ferguson also failed that test, scoring only 9 out of 16. And the importance of that test is even people with genuine memory deficits would not have been expected to score that low. This also provided a strong indication of malingering. And finally, Dr. Panuzzo administered the Wechsler Memory Scale 4 test, which also contains the index of effort. Again, Mr. Ferguson scored quite poorly, indicating likely feigning. The combination of these tests, it's within the expert's discretion to say whether or not we conclude that there is or is not malingering. I acknowledge that there were tests earlier that showed no malingering, but that's exactly why we have experts. I, as a layperson, could not look at these tests and say one way or another, but Dr. Panuzzo and Dr. Marquez took into account all the tests and concluded that there was malingering here. That was their best professional opinion. The district court adopted that opinion, and here, on clear error review, this court would have no room to reverse that decision. With respect to the second issue, the Peralt decision cited in the 28J letter is both irrelevant and the argument was waived below. As far as its irrelevance, my colleague acknowledged that this was not a 403 decision and it was not about child pornography. It was a Rule 404 decision about how many other instances of child molestation can come in. There is no cause for this court to extend the reasoning of that decision to the 403 context with child pornography. Furthermore, this court didn't even hold that this seriatim weighing of marginal value is necessary. The court said it may be necessary in certain cases, and it was not necessary here. This argument was also waived below. There were three objections in the trial court to the images and videos that came in. They objected to the first image based on Rule 403. Then they objected only once to Exhibits 32 through 40, which were the rest of the videos, and those were admitted at the same time. Finally, they made a third final objection to Exhibits 41 through 55, which were the 15 images. On each objection, they said, we object based on the previous record and argument weight, which was the 403 decision. If they had wanted to make the argument that image number 7, 8, or 9 had insufficient probative value because their marginal value was decreased, they would have needed to say that to the district court so the district court could make that determination as to each video or each image. They didn't do that below, and so that argument has been forfeited. Judge Morris is also correct that Rule 403 determinations that are implicit have been affirmed by this court. I do apologize that we did not cite the evidence below, but did not cite those decisions, but I can give you at least the Silva case from 2018, which said this explicitly. One case that was cited that said this is the Evans decision from the Eighth Circuit, which the reply brief relied on very heavily. The Evans decision said explicitly, here in the Eighth Circuit, we allow the district court's implicit Rule 403 decision to stand, even if the district court didn't, on the record, say how it was weighing the probative and prejudicial values. And the reason we didn't cite these cases, which again, we probably should have, is because that's not what happened here. The district court did weigh the probative and prejudicial values. It discussed the probative value at the pretrial conference where it said, I understand now that these images are necessary to show the ages of these children and to show that Mr. Ferguson knew what the ages of these children are. And in the motion, in the order denying the motion for a new trial, the court explained why the risk of unfair prejudice was mitigated. There was only a small collection, a small sample of the videos shown. And as the court has noted already, the videos were played without sound. Again, the Evans decision that was cited and relied heavily on in the reply brief is actually helpful for the government here. That court admitted 5 minutes of child pornography and some of video child pornography and somewhere around 22 images. 22 images is more than we have here, and 5 minutes is on par with what we have in this case. The record does not specify the exact number of seconds videos 6 through 10 were played, but in the briefing on the new trial motion, both parties agreed that it was only a few seconds. And it was the defense side that characterized each video as being played for 2 to 3 seconds. So by my math, videos 6 through 10 were played for around 15 seconds, and certainly for no more than a minute. So then the total time the jury sat watching child pornography could not have exceeded 7 minutes. And that's on par with what happened in the Evans decision. This court doesn't sit to draw bright line rules about exactly how much child pornography can be admitted. That decision is committed to the sound discretion of the district court when it evaluates the context of the entire trial. And I would note that the Cunningham decision, on which the defense has relied heavily as well, also said explicitly, we are not drawing a bright line rule about how much child pornography is admitted. The Cunningham court said the district court erred here because it never viewed the child pornography videos before admitting it. We have no indication of record that this mistake was made here. The district court had all the child pornography that was going to be shown to the jury on a disc before, and we should presume that the district court viewed those videos ahead of time. Turning to the final issue on prosecutorial misconduct, there is no prosecutorial misconduct here because all that happened was Agent Rivers had changed his mind about whether the two images from the son's laptop were on the son's laptop were or were not child pornography.
Now, have you argued that Judge White's contrary factual finding was clearly erroneous?
We are not cross-appealing to have you reverse Judge White on that point, but if the court agrees with us, we would certainly appreciate if the opinion would say that there was no prosecutorial misconduct.
Well, I don't even know that you need a cross-appeal. I don't think you're enlarging the scope of the judgment, but if you are asking us to affirm on an alternative ground, which I think it would have to be, because Judge White specifically found that the government had committed a disclosure violation. I think you have a strong argument that Agent Rivers, his change in his testimony is not necessarily a reflection on whether the prosecutor knew that Agent Rivers was going to change his version. But Judge White certainly thought so because he specifically found there was a disclosure violation. And if we're bound to follow his factual findings, I don't know how we can credit your first argument on that point.
So 2 points on that. First, I don't know how persuasive the court will find this, but Judge White did leave some wiggle room in his opinion. He never came out and said that there was a discovery violation. He used couching language like there appears to have been a violation. And the court tends to agree with the defense argument. Moving on, though. It's not a factual determination of whether or not there was a discovery violation. That's a legal question this court can review de novo. Because that's comes down to the interpretation of Rule 16. The facts are not in dispute here. We acknowledge fully that Agent Rivers said in the July 2019 meeting that he thought these images were child pornography. And we also admit that on redirect, he said the two images from the son's laptop, putting aside the image from the daughter's laptop, the two images on the son's laptop, he would not characterize as child pornography. And then we introduced these two images to the jury and went through step by step with Special Agent Rivers, his analysis of why these two images he now thinks are not child pornography.
Isn't so the jury pretty significant in terms of his defense, which was simply that because there was child pornography on two other laptops found in the home that belonged to the son and daughter, and there was no particular information that he was the person that downloaded these images, it could have been someone else. That was his defense. He opened up with that. And now that kind of blows that defense for him, doesn't it? And it's sudden. He thinks, based on this July meeting with the prosecutor and with the agent, that they're saying, well, you can't have these laptops because there's child pornography on them. How would that be if we assume it's a discovery violation, which the judge somewhat found, that may not be harmless.
Well, the district court found it was harmless.
I'm asking you, how do we get there?
Because the jury had all the information before it. It saw the two images and it heard Special Agent Rivers' testimony about why he no longer thinks these images are child pornography.
And why he did think they were a few months before and wouldn't let them have the laptops because of it?
Yes, that came out in cross-examination. And that's exactly what the district court said here. It said, yes, this is not ideal, but this is something you can cover in cross-examination. And defense counsel did vigorously cross-examine Special Agent Rivers about that. So whatever impeachment value they were going to get, they already got. There's just not a universe in which anything else could have happened here. Putting aside, obviously, the most ideal universe where we figured out ahead of time that these were not images of child pornography and told them. But taking the universe as it was, the special agent testified that he did tell them in July 2019 that these were images of child pornography. And we introduced the images so the jury can judge for themselves whether these were or were not child pornography. And the other main point of why this is harmless error is because it just does not matter here. These two images differ so qualitatively and quantitatively from the 1,900 images and 50 videos that were found on Ferguson's computer under the Randy user account that the jury could reasonably have rejected any implication that someone who had two images of questionable validity would also be the person who had downloaded all these other videos. Remember, the jury also heard from Special Agent Rivers Mr. Ferguson's confession that he did this, and they heard from Special Agent Rivers that Mr. Ferguson never once suggested that his wife or his son or his daughter or anyone else was responsible for the child pornography. The evidence was overwhelming in this case, and that's why the jury returned a guilty verdict after less than 1 hour of deliberation. And so that's why any error here, and again, we don't concede that there was error or any prosecutorial misconduct, did not affect the jury verdict, and the district court did not abuse its discretion in declining to grant a mistrial. If the court has no other questions, we ask you to affirm the judgment of the court.
I'm good.
Okay, thank you, counsel.
Did you want to do a minute?
Yes, I think I...
Yes, it's on there.
To give 1 minute.
Thank you again. On Judge Moritz's question just now about the changing the position on the child pornography, again, this is not just something that got presented at trial, because they certainly capitalized on it at trial. But if they had known that there were questions about whether this was child pornography back in the summer of 2019, the defense may have gone in a completely different direction. The defense relied upon this all the way up until the second day of trial. And I think that's why this makes this so prejudicial and something that is definitely not a fair trial. And I'm glad you guys pointed out that Judge White found that this was a Rule 16, or that it appeared to be a Rule 16 violation. I think it's pretty clear that he thought it was a violation. And I do want to point out that the standard of review on the competency issue, I don't think is a clear error. It's a de novo, and the findings of fact are for clear error. We don't have any findings of fact here because the judge, Judge White, simply said, I find her more persuasive than her. And that's the only finding we have. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. This matter will be submitted.